Okay, let's go ahead and get started with our class this morning. We have this morning's class and then Wednesday night before the new quarter begins next Sunday. So we're coming to the end of this study of the three-cycle approach. We went through the first cycle, learning what all the periods and categories of the Bible are, 17 of them. And then we went through in the second cycle, and we learned basically what events go in this period. And then we went into the third cycle, in which we are looking at the scriptures where these periods are found. And we have, for several classes now, been sort of weaving the last two cycles together, going over and over the events, because every presentation of this that I give, I realize I have to tailor it for the audience. And, you know, sometimes you'll deal with people in general who have a real good knowledge of the facts. If that's true, then you don't have to dwell as much on the events. Most of the time, though, you do have to dwell on the events. Make sure that everybody in the class knows about that. Now, a lot of times you'll have some people who are pretty well informed, but you may have a good number who are not. And so you have to go for the benefit of those who are not as well informed, you know. In other words, do you see what I'm saying? You have to gauge your material on the basis of those who need the most and present it that way. So we've been really working on that, and what we've done now is we've gotten to the return from captivity. You remember the return from captivity. Now the period just before that is captivity, and before that is Judah alone, and before that the divided kingdom, and then before that the united kingdom. So we've been working on that, and also showing you that you have 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and then the parallel of 1 and 2 Chronicles. And then in dealing with now in those books, we deal with the United Kingdom, the Divided Kingdom, and Judah alone, and actually begin the captivity. But primarily, our emphasis in the captivity involves what three books? Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel. That is the chronological order. Now, the order they're found in the listing of the books would be what? Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. That's right. Because they're arranged primarily according to length and not to chronology. All right, so then we come to the return. So that's what I want to get in on this morning, and let's work on that return once again. All right. So in the in thinking about the return, basically, how many phases or returns do we count? There are three. All right, the first one is in the year, yes, 536. This one was led by what man? All right. And when you're doing it on the board like this, the biggest struggle to me is to be sure I have the Z turned right. Zerubbabel. Now, the goal in this return was what? What were they doing? All right, that's right. So rebuild the temple. Now there's another name associated with this, but I don't stress that at this time. Now when we go through it, we look at it. But there's another name, Sheshbazzar. And scholars are divided on whether he was somebody else or whether that was just another name for Zerubbabel. I'm inclined to think it was another name for Zerubbabel, because we simply don't find much about what this Sheshbazzar did other than what Zerubbabel did. So I'm inclined to think he's the same one. So that's the reason why at this point, you know, you don't go into everything. So Zerubbabel rebuilt a temple. They got back, laid the foundation. Their neighbors came and said, "Can we help? We want to help." And what did the Jews there say, Zerubbabel and his fellow Jews? No. Because why? That's right. You have nothing in common with us. They were pagan. And so then they began to just keep them, you know, give them trouble and everything like that. Now, did they write to Cyrus and say, these people are down here rebuilding the walls of this city. Did you want them to do that? No, because they knew if they did, what would Cyrus tell them? Well, of course I told them to. So they don't do that until Cyrus is dead. And so when his son is reigning, then they write him and they tell him to, they point him in a certain direction. They don't say, "See if Cyrus made a decree." Instead, what do they tell him to check into? The history of Jerusalem. What did they say about Jerusalem? It's been a troublesome city, a strong city with strong kings, and if they rebuild that city, you won't have a kingdom on this side of the river. Well, when he checked into that, what did he find out about Jerusalem? That those things were true. So he said, "Stop that right now." So that officially put it to a stop. See, before that, it was just put to a stop because of the trouble they were encountering. Their neighbors were giving them trouble. So, but now it's official. And so the Jews sort of say, "Oh, well, see, oh, well, we might as well finish our own houses." And so they got busy with their own stuff, you know, and just let the temple, the foundation of the temple just lay there, just doing nothing. No, doing nothing on it. So, 536, in 520, God raises up two men, two prophets. Now, do you remember who those prophets are? That's right. Now, this is in 520. Now, see, this is associated with the same period as this first return. It's 16 years later. But now he raises up Haggai and Zechariah. And both of these prophets are to stir the people up. And in a way, Haggai does that more directly than Zechariah does. What Zechariah does is, in a very elaborate and beautiful series of visions, he helps the people to see that this temple here, which you regard as not amounting to much, it's just the beginning of what God has in mind. Now, do all of you grasp that? And can you, you know, we're in such a wonderful position because living this long afterward and having the entire completed Bible here before us, we can look at those people there, and Zechariah was saying, "Oh, God has so much more wonderful things in store for you. This is just the beginning." Do you see that we could say this is a period of restoration? If the Jews had really plunged in here and had benefited from the spiritual lessons that had been taught in the captivity, if they had come back and really embraced their covenant with the Lord and had put Him first in their lives, and had done that all these 400 years of silence that followed, when it came time for Christ to come, it would have been a glorious, triumphant coming to a people that were ready to welcome Him. Now, can you all see how that would have been indeed a glorious thing? Well, that didn't happen. It was kind of hit or miss. They did not measure up and use the time. It's really sad because when you read Malachi, the last of these Old Testament prophets, do you remember whether Malachi was very complimentary to these Jews. He was not. And especially he was not complimentary to the priests. Of all people who should have been leading the Jews in their embrace of the spiritual aspect of the covenant they had with God, it should have been the priests. So Zechariah was primarily trying to help these people see the glories that awaited them spiritually. So don't get hung up on this foundation out here that's smaller than the other one was. You all see that? See, they were hung up on that little foundation. Now, some of them that hadn't ever seen the other foundation, they were saying, "Oh, yay!" And they were so glad. But those that were old enough, they had seen the first temple, and there were some there that could remember the first temple. What did they do when they saw this new foundation? They cried. They wept. So these prophets were both to stir the people up and get them going again, but also to help them understand that God had in mind a much more glorious future than would be indicated if you just looked at the smaller foundation of the temple. You know, that would sound like a step down. So what God is wanting them to know is, no, this is not a step down, because I have much more in mind for you than merely what is signified in this temple foundation. So they got the people going again, and they worked hard, and by 516, they had the temple built. Well, let's put it like that. The temple built. So, took them 20 years. But when they really got on it, it took them 4 years. So, here the temple is built now. And I remember nearly 50 years ago when I was teaching this as a guy that really didn't know beans about it. And I remember the class where I was teaching this, and one of the men who was famous for being a cynic and kind of an unbeliever, later on that guy became a Christian, and was a wonderful Christian, but he had to have an encounter with a bull before he decided to obey the gospel. That's an interesting story I'll need to tell you about sometime. But he said, "Well, it seems funny to me that they'd build the walls of the temple, build a temple before they'd build the walls of the city." And so here I am in my mind trying to think, well, which was it that they were building here? I couldn't remember, because I didn't know really. I couldn't remember. And so I went ahead and I took a chance that it was the temple. It was the temple they were building. And so I just read him the riot act about not having faith, hoping I was right. but huh?
You had faith in your theory.
I had faith in my theory, and I had faith in the idea that, to me, logically, God would say, "I want you to get that temple built first." And that seemed to fit. Well, of course, doesn't really matter what I think, but it is true that that's the way God looked at it. He wanted them to get that temple built first, because one of the points he makes in Zechariah is, "I will be a wall of fire about you." See, of course, then I didn't know Zechariah. But that's what he was saying. You need to get this temple built, because that was first priority. And they hadn't done it. So through Haggai, God says, things have not gone as you planned for them to go when you came back. Do you know why? And so, "Oh, well, we haven't had time to build the temple." You've had time to build your own houses and seal them on the inside. In other words, you have not only put up the framework, you've done the sheetrock, the painting, and the decorating. So he just shot that one right out of the water. And so here's the first episode. They get that temple rebuilt. Now, some years go by. Another generation goes by. and the second return. And let me go ahead and point this out, that though this is not a return, it does fit between the first and second return, and that is the story of Esther. The story of Esther fits into that, between the first and second return, right around, real close to about 480, 479, somewhere in there. But the second return now is going to be, anyone know what date that second return is? All right, 458. And who leads this second return? Ezra, that's right, Ezra. All right, now look in the book of Ezra, everyone. Look in the book of Ezra. And Ezra 1 would be an excellent place to start. And look through until you come to a chapter that seems to focus on Ezra himself. What chapter? 7. All right, so that means that, look, in this first return, we have Ezra 1 through 6. Now, in the second return, we're going to have it Ezra 7 through what? The end, which is what? 10. Ezra 7 through 10. Now, look at the first of chapter 7, as it is telling about Ezra. Scott, could you read those first few verses of Ezra 7, giving the genealogy of Ezra there? So what does this make Ezra? See? He's a priest. Traces his genealogy all the way back to Aaron. And in his genealogy, you've got some very notable names like Hilkiah. Hilkiah. Now, there were several Hilkiahs, but the one that is the most famous is the Hilkiah in the days of King Josiah. Josiah. So this Ezra's genealogy takes him back through the line of the priest all the way back. Notice that Ezra does not go back through the line of Ithamar. He does not go back through Ithamar. He goes back through Zadok. And Zadok goes back through Eleazar. And so as you look back there, you know, you see Phinehas, and then Eleazar, and then Aaron. Does everybody see that? So here we have the priest. And not only is Ezra a priest, but in later verses he is called a ready scribe. So that he was an expert in the law. And so Ezra is going to come back, and he's going to help the people purify their religion. And so he leads a contingent of about 4,000 in round numbers, about 4,000. And so they are coming back. They have priests. They call for Levites. They call for Nethinim. Now the Nethinim are people who, first of all, comes from a word that we have in our name, Nathan. So the word Nathan is from Hebrew, and it means to give. He gave. The Nethinim are the given ones. And they were the old Gibeonites. Do all of you remember the story of the Gibeonites from Joshua 9? They tricked the Israelites, and then the Israelites said, okay, we will honor our covenant, but you're going to have to what? You're going to have to work as servants, hauling the wood, carrying the water for the temple. So they turned into an honored group of people in Israelite society. So he leads them, and as they're going to be going back, Ezra, it's kind of funny to me because Ezra has really been telling Artaxerxes how great our God is. How great our God is. And then he realizes that they're going to be carrying a lot of gold and silver. So it would really be nice for them to have a nice big bodyguard, a nice big group of armed men to protect them, except what's he been bragging about? About how God's going to look after us. Yes, God will look after us. And so now he's ashamed to ask Artaxerxes, hey, by the way, could we have an army? And so he doesn't ask for an army. Instead, what he does is he and the people gather and they pray and they fast and they ask God to look after them. And guess what? He does. So they make their way back. And so the thing that they do when he gets back, they deliver the things that they brought with them, the vessels and gold and silver and stuff like that. But they work on purifying the religion. And one of the problems that he encounters is the mixed marriages. Now, the mixed marriages mean the marriages between the Hebrew men and the women of the pagan people. And of course, in the law, that had been forbidden. And they had done it nevertheless, pretty freely. And so that meant that the children spoke partly the language of the Jews and partly the language of... I heard somebody say it. What was it? Ashdod. Now, back through the years, preachers would talk about speaking the language of Ashdod. And what they meant was when we begin to talk in terms that reflect denominational ideas and theories, because we have been feeding too much at that trough. So we have just imbibed all kinds of ideas and false ideas and so on from denominational concepts. So they used it a lot to talk about that. Well, in this case, it was the matter that the Hebrew man had married a woman who was a pagan, and so she spoke another language, and so the children spoke partly one and partly the other. And so that was a huge problem because it was that mixed marriage problem and that dabbling in idolatry that had caused them to go into the captivity in the first place. So if you look in Ezra 9, look in Ezra 9, and what do you see Ezra doing there? What is Ezra do in 9? Right. And in this prayer, the people, they're kind of watching Ezra, and Ezra is just stunned. He just yanks hair out. So if you saw that happening, what would you be thinking? I don't believe he likes this. They could tell he was very upset by it. Well, you know, sometimes what we need is to see our leaders upset. If the thing is bad, if it's wrong, we need to see leaders upset about it instead of being cool. You know, it doesn't bother me, I can take it. Well, there are times that the proper reaction is to be upset and to be disappointed and to let that disappointment show. And so Ezra, there was no doubt in anybody observing Ezra that this is awful. And so they came to him and said, Ezra, don't let your heart be discouraged. Whatever you need to do, you do it. We'll be with you. We'll take whatever time is necessary and we'll get this job done. And so they really encouraged Ezra in that regard. And it took a long time because we don't have the details, but there were families that had to be parted. There were children to be dealt with. And I don't have any idea what all the details were. But I think that probably some kind of disposition to provide some kind of care for the children and stuff like that, there were things to be seen about like that. And it took time to work their way through it. But they did. And it wasn't that after a while, well, it's okay for you to keep them. It's okay for you to keep these wives. No, that was not ever in the cards. Never. They had to get these marriages. They had, you know, sometimes people say, well, I believe that God intends for us to, for anybody to be married. What about these people? Just because God gave a basic right to a man and woman to be married in the beginning does not mean that in all circumstances it's okay for a given person to be married. Because the circumstances of that marriage and of their background have to come into play. And this is an illustration of that fact. So they get that done, and you would think that, oh wow, they have now got that problem settled. But then, who's the third one? Nehemiah. Now, what year is Nehemiah? 445. And we figure that, by the way, on the basis of the fact that the Artaxerxes that's mentioned as the king to which Nehemiah was cupbearer, he began his reign in 465. And this was in the 20th year of Artaxerxes. So if it was in the 20th year of Artaxerxes and he began in 465, what year would it be? See, 445. Take 20 from 465, you get 445. Everybody see that? So that's the way they got that figure. And then, let me just ask, what date have you heard for Malachi? Have you ever heard the figure 432? Well, it can't be exact, but the way that figure is come up with is that you take the approximately 12 years that Nehemiah works here in Jerusalem and so on, you subtract that, and that's how some get that figure. But as Kent was saying, there are other dates that are given too, but it's in that area. But that's the way they get that date. So, this is Nehemiah, and do you remember what Nehemiah was concerned with? What did he come back to lead the people to do? All right, here they are rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. So he leads the people to do that. And now we've looked at the scripture here, you know, Ezra 1 through 6, that's the first return. Ezra 7 through 10, that's the second return. And so in Nehemiah, we have the book of Nehemiah. And also, remember the books of Haggai and Zechariah. So I'm just trying to make sure. Oh yeah, and here we have the book of Esther. And then the one other book over here is toward the end of Nehemiah's time, we have Malachi. Now, toward the end of that time that Nehemiah was there, he went back to Persia. And while he was going back to Persia, there were some unfortunate things that happened. The high priest, by this time, the high priest was just I don't know, he was almost like a political guy or something like that. And he was hobnobbing with the enemies of Nehemiah and the people. And I think that it is likely in that period when Nehemiah was going back to Babylon for a while and things got out of hand in Jerusalem that quickly that Malachi prophesied. And one of the things that Malachi prophesied about was, You're not providing the offerings. You've stolen from God. How have we stolen from God? And that's the style that Malachi has. You know, he'll kind of make an accusation as if it were to the people and then have their objection. How have we stolen from God? in that you have not given him the offerings that you were supposed to give? Well, one of the things that Nehemiah had done was to get them doing that. But when he was gone, guess what? They let it slide. Now, some of you have heard me tell about the clock winder. Any of you heard me tell about the clock winder? All right. I'm finding one or two heads shaking like that, and that's all I need. That's all I need. So, I like to do it this way. There are two kinds of people in the world. And I'm telling you that so that you can put yourself in whichever slot you belong. So here we are all sitting here, and there is a big old grandfather's clock up here, and it's ticking away. And so we're all aware of the ticking of the clock. And after a while, we are aware that the ticking is not going on with the vigor that it used to. If you've ever dealt with the old clocks like that, you would know that, yeah, they keep on ticking, but you can begin to tell that they don't quite have the vigor that they did have, and they're going to need to be rewound. So we're all sitting here listening to the clock running down. And so we begin to comment to one another that, yeah, it sounds like it's getting slower, doesn't it? Yeah, it sure does. Yeah, if somebody doesn't wind that clock, it's probably going to stop. Yes, I think you're right. I don't know why somebody doesn't wind the clock. You'd think that there would be somebody that was appointed to wind that clock. Yes, that's right. Because everybody knows if you don't keep them wound, they don't. And so, you know, we go on chatting around, and finally it stops. And we all say, I thought it was going to. That's exactly what I expected, because nobody wound that clock. Except now that I said there are two kinds of people. So there's one kind of person who says, yes, it is. And he goes over here and he winds the clock. He took it upon himself to wind that clock. Guess which category most people fall into, the clock winder or those that just observe the clock running down? Those who observe the clock running down but don't do anything. So to me, Nehemiah is a wonderful example of a clock winder, and that's something we all need to be, clock winders. By the way, I was preaching and making this point in Brazil one time, and my translator, who was an excellent man, Dennis Allen, I think you all know something of him, but anyway, Dennis stopped at that moment, and he had his family, who, you know, were Native Americans. They, no, they're not Indians, but they were from the United States. The English was their native language, and he said to them, how do you translate clock? So I had used a term that he just wasn't at all sure how to translate that into Portuguese. So anyway, that was pretty funny. But, you know, isn't that a point to make there? And Nehemiah went away back to Persia. And what happened to the clock? It just ran down. Not a soul there. Wind the clock again. He comes back, he finds the clock run down. What does he do? He winds that thing back up, gets it going again. Nehemiah was a man who sought very diligently to do the will of God. But in this time, there at the end of that period, approaching 432, 433, Malachi says, basically, he says, you have failed. You have failed. And you priests, you have utterly failed. You were supposed to be teachers of the law. And you haven't taught. You not only have not taught, you haven't lived. Your wives have covered the altar at which you're ministering. They've covered the altar with tears because you have put them away for younger women. This was the priest. And so he says, you've robbed God. Well, where have we robbed God? In that you don't offer the offerings, and you bring to God things that you sure wouldn't offer your governor. Like, how many of you would offer your governor a blind cow? You know, I have a wonderful present for you. I have a cow that was gored in the eye the other day, and I can't use him for anything else. I'm going to give him to you. Would the governor be honored? See that? And yet, that's what you do with God. You take an animal that, I think he's going to die anyhow, I'm going to give him to the Lord. Because since I'm going to lose it anyway, I might as well give it to the Lord. See that? And so that's what Malachi did. And Malachi said, you all are saying, oh, I wish the Lord would come. Oh, I wish the Lord would come. Well, now, wait a minute. When the Lord does come, which one of you thinks you're going to be able to stand before him? Because he's not going to come and just pat you on the head. He's going to come and he's going to bring judgment as well as deliverance and salvation. And who do you think will be able to stand before him in judgment when he comes? And of course, you recall that when Jesus came, there were those who accepted him, but what about others? Remember John? He said he came unto his own. And what's the rest of that? And his own received him not. That's right. So by the time you come to the end, this brings you, do you see, this brings you to the close of the Old Testament. This is the end of Revelation for the Old Testament. And now what's the next period? Years of silence. Now what scriptures tell about this? None, because it's the years of what? Silence. The only thing that gives us any guidance through here is the prophecies of Daniel, the visions that he sees, particularly in 2 and 7, but really as well in 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. However, I don't really know much about 10, 11, and 12. And that's not just a confession. I don't think anybody else knows much about those. But in 2 and 7, we have a very clear picture of the succession of empires from the Babylonian through the Medo-Persian, through the Grecian, to the Roman. And the point that God makes is that in the days of that Roman Empire, in the days of that fourth empire, the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. So the years of silence. The years of silence occupy around 400 years, a little over 400 years. Now, we have Wednesday night, but let me go ahead and tell you something else. The next period is what? The life of Christ. Now, listen. I'm going to let you do this all by yourselves. Tell me the scriptures where we find the life of Christ. That's it. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The early church, guess where we find that? Acts. And then the letters to the Christians. Now, not only do we have those letters included, but many of them are written during the course of the book of Acts so that they can be fitted into the historical context of the book of Acts. So, in other words, I wanted to kind of get that before you, and then Wednesday night I'm going to work on just tying up some loose ends and packing in a little chinking here and there and do some things like that. But I feel really good with what we've been able to accomplish here. In this years of silence, There are some really exciting stories in that, but it is a period that most of us have not studied about. We just haven't studied that at all. And so it involves a great mass of information that we've never studied before. So it makes it kind of difficult. So to simplify things, what I'd like you to do is remember that you've got four threads of history that have to be woven together. Now, to make it easy, one of the threads would be perfectly obvious if you thought about it. It would be the Jews. Right? See, we're going to want to know what happened to the Jews in this 400 years. So does everybody see that? That'd be a very logical, natural thing. The principal thing, in fact, we'd be interested in what's happening to the Jews in these years. And then the second thing, which would be easy to remember, is what empire was in power at the close of this Old Testament period of Revelation, Nehemiah and Malachi? Persia. We want to know what happened to the Persian Empire. So, the Persian Empire lasted almost exactly 100 years after Malachi. Now see, that's easy, right? Jewish history, which will go all the way through. Persian history, about another 100 years. And then do you remember what force overthrew the Persian Empire? The Macedonian, the Grecian, Alexandrian, whatever you call it, the Hellenistic Empire. So do you know what the third thread is? The Hellenistic Empire, the Greek Empire, Alexander. But you see how it interacted with that second one because it overthrew it. So if you're taking that thread through, you take that thread through and you get right here and suddenly that thread changes color. You see that in our tapestry? It's been the Persian to here, and then from here on, it's another empire. The Grecian. That's three of them. Now, can you guess what the fourth one is? Roman. Very good. Very good. Absolutely great. So, now look at it. You got those four threads. The Jews, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. And so all you have to do is to just keep in mind. Now, I could do it, but I don't really have any interest in learning all the Persian kings. I know the Persian kings that impact on the Bible story. And then I know the last Persian king, and that's all I think I need to know. And the last Persian king was Darius III. He's the one that Alexander didn't kill him. Probably his own men killed him. We're not exactly positive about that. But he did die. And with his death, the Persian Empire came to an end. So here we have Alexander. And you've heard of Alexander forging his empire in about 12 years. Beginning as just a young man of 20. About 12 years, he forges that empire, reaching all the way from Macedonia to the borders of India. And then guess what Alexander did? Yeah, he died. That's right, he died. And this wonderful empire, you know what happened? It just fell apart into big pieces because his loyal generals went at it, hammer and tong, against each other. Each one of them wanting to carve out the biggest chunk for himself. And so they established these smaller kingdoms and empires that fought with each other for control. And guess who was caught in the middle? The Jews. There's that thread. The Jews caught in the middle. And so after a while, one of these kingdoms gained precedence over the other. And this brings us to the time of a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes, which the Jews called Antiochus Epimenes. Epiphanes meant the manifestation of God. Epimenes meant madman. So that brings about the situation that created the blank revolt. Maccabean revolt. That's right. Okay, well, we'll stop for now.